Sure. All right. You are here for the beginning of the study of the book of Ezekiel. I think what you'll notice is that I'll be approaching the book of Ezekiel different than we did Isaiah or many other books. Many other books we've kind of approached, and I always say that Ezekiel, to me, is one of the most difficult books because all of us as Bible teachers will have certain approaches to how we approach the scripture and stuff. And I think I've tried to deal with Ezekiel from the same way I've done the other. Ezekiel is distinct in this sense. Ezekiel is a series of visions and messages that God gives. And I think you have, at least I have difficulty when I try to do it just verse by verse instead of receive a particular vision as a whole. Okay, so what we're going to attempt to do, which again is challenging for me, so you pray for me, because I like the verse by verse, and we're going to read the verses, but I don't think you can grasp Ezekiel, or you'll have difficulty grasping it unless, if you don't grasp it at least vision by vision. Okay, you understand what I'm saying there? Where some of the other verses, some of the other books that we could start and stop in the middle, we're going to try to deal with a vision or a chapter. A lot of times they're in a chapter form. So you get the whole picture of what he's saying. He is a man that was called of God at a particular time. We're told that he held both the office of prophet and priest. Ezekiel, the name Ezekiel means, I wrote it on the board, is that God strengthens. And again, it speaks of the time that God has called this man, the message that God has given this man. It's not an easy message to give. At the time of Ezekiel, there were many other self-professed prophets who said that they spoke in the name of the Lord. And Ezekiel challenges them the same way Isaiah did, the same way that Jeremiah did. He challenges them by saying that they are not speaking the words of God. And he challenges them that his message from God is almost 180 degrees different from what the popular prophets were saying at that time. Basically, what the popular prophets were saying is, very soon we will return to Jerusalem and we will see the beautiful city and we will see the beautiful temple. And what Ezekiel had to say, of course, what God told him to say was, there will be no city and there will be no temple. That which you left will not be standing when you get back. Okay? So that's the message that he had. Ezekiel is after the time of Isaiah, which we just finished studying. Ezekiel was I got some dates up here for you. Ezekiel is one of those books that we have. He talks about his timing. Okay, he talks about, so we have a very good indication about when he was, what was going on. He's probably one of the most exact books when it comes to timing, and we can put he helps us with the timing of Daniel. He helps us with the timing of Jeremiah. He helps us with the timing of other things, but because he's very exact in what he writes down. Ezekiel born approximately 622 BC. Okay? He would be a contemporary of Daniel. Many believe that he'd be close to the same age as Daniel was. Okay? We'll talk in just a moment about the historical background, how that all ties in. He was deported in 597 BC. Deported simply means he was taken with the captives to Babylon in 597 BC. Nebuchadnezzar came and took them. And again, when we talk about some of the historical things, we'll talk about that in a moment. He prophesied. He began prophesying about 5 years after, and he says it, and you'll see it in his writing. About 5 years after he is taken captivity, that's when he begins to prophesy. So about 592 BC to 570 BC, we have him. You notice something? Your numbers are going backwards? Okay. Hope that doesn't just sort of mess up your mind, but we're BC now, okay? And then he died around 560 BC. Okay, so this is Ezekiel. He did not live as long as Daniel did. Daniel lived to be quite an old man, you know. But when we put this now in the historical perspective of what is going on. Remember, we just finished Isaiah. Isaiah prophesied during the time of the fall, remember, of the northern kingdom. Approximately 120 years after the fall of the northern kingdom, you have the fall of Judah, the southern kingdom. God used Isaiah to be a primary prophet. There were other minor prophets, but Isaiah to be the primary prophet to the southern kingdom. And he gave them great warning. You remember he said, because you, the southern kingdom, did not look to your brothers from the north and learn from them, your punishment will actually be greater. Your sin is greater, and your punishment will be greater. God gave them approximately 100 years to turn back. He gave them warning after warning after warning. You have the litany of kings that passed through there. You had the good kings. Who were two of the good kings during the time of Isaiah? You remember Hezekiah and Josiah would probably be the two main. But after Josiah, there is this very evil king that comes, and God finally says, now remember, I just want to remind you, during Josiah, Josiah was a man after God's own heart too. He was a good king. The problem was that the people had fallen so far away from God that though the king had enacted decrees to say, get rid of these idols, get rid of this, there's no indication that the people's heart ever really turned back to God. Okay? Everybody understand that? You had a king that was leading properly and God blessed him, but Josiah had a tough reign. Can you imagine him being a king of such people? And some people would say that he died out of time. Of course, there is no out of time with God, but you know, he was killed in battle. Okay, from him, you have a very evil king. Anybody remember their name? Huh? Well, before him. Huh? No, before him.
Before Josiah.
Manasseh. Okay? He's not before Josiah, he's after Josiah. And it is under the rule of Manasseh that God says, I'm done. Or you're done, not he's done, you're done. And he says, you've crossed the line too far. Remember what Manasseh did? He enacted, as a part of what they did as a societal group, he enacted the worship of the god Molech, where they would take their children into the valley of what we would call Gehenna, or Henon, Gehenna, and he had them sacrifice their babies to this god Molech. And god Molech was a god that was made out of brass for the most part. And what they would do is they would build it in such a way that the arms of the god would heat up red hot. They would take their babies and they would lay their babies into the arms of this god, and they would be burned alive in the arms of God. And somehow they thought this was... It's incredible that people become so corrupt that they think this is somehow acceptable. And God said, that's it. What's going to happen now is going to happen. Okay? Alright, so... Basically, we have that as the judgment of Isaiah. Okay, now we're going to have. Now we move into Ezekiel, and in Ezekiel we have the fulfillment of God's judgment that He spoke primarily through Isaiah concerning the southern kingdom. Remember, Isaiah said that God will raise up the Babylonians. At the beginning of Isaiah's prophecy, no one had any concept that the Babylonians would be here. Remember, their problems was with Assyria at that time. And no one really thought Assyria would fall very quickly, but God did exactly what He said. He raised up the Babylonians. The other thing that's very curious to me, or wonderful to me, is Isaiah not only spoke about the Babylonians, but he also spoke about, he even called Cyrus by name in his book. You know, that God would eventually raise up Cyrus, and Cyrus has to do with the kingdom of the Medes and the Persian, and had to do more with Daniel's prophecy than anything else. But, so, and again, I'm trying to set some of the background here so you know where we're at. In fulfillment of God's prophecy that He would destroy the southern kingdom, He raises up Nebuchadnezzar. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar attacks Jerusalem for the first time. Okay? Now there are three attacks. First one, what did I say? 605 BC. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar comes and he attacks Jerusalem. In this attack, we have recorded for us that he doesn't take the whole city. He doesn't destroy the whole city. Okay? The Babylonians move through areas, and their purpose was not so much destruction, because you know when you destroy something, what do you got to do? You got to rebuild. So their view was not destruction, but assimilation. So that what they would do is they would go through and then they would conscript the best of the land to serve the king of Babylon. Thus you have the incident of Daniel. The whole story of Daniel, okay, is that, remember, that they were, Daniel, and it's more than just these guys, but for us, for the biblical story, you have the story of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, okay? And they were part of the finest of the young men of Judah. And so when Nebuchadnezzar came through the first time, he took the finest of the young men. And remember, Daniel and these three Hebrew young men were all made eunuchs in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. And then God used Daniel to be his prophet to the Gentile king. So while Ezekiel is God's prophet and priest to his people in captivity, you have Daniel, who God has raised up to be the prophet to the Gentile king. So you have, at the same time, you have Daniel prophesying in the palace at Babylon. You have Ezekiel prophesying. We'll talk about where he is in just a moment. Okay, everybody got that? Elaine. Mm-hmm.
In Jeremiah that we're doing in our Bible study, talks about Hananiah that broke the yoke off of Jeremiah's neck.
Mm-hmm.
Shadrach, his name was Hananiah prior to changing it. Is that the same?
No, it's not the same guy. It's not the same guy. No. Yeah, it's not the same. That's a common name, but it's not the same guy. Because that guy... that Hananiah is... Yeah, you read that, he's gone. Any other questions? We deal with some of this historical background. It's fascinating. I mean, this is one of the most fascinating times in history as far as I'm concerned. You know, and if you ever want to hear someone really teach this with every name, every date, everything, Doug Jurgensen does such a tremendous job on this history stuff. David, do you have something?
So when can we date the book of Ezekiel?
Well, it would be in this area right here where he prophesied.
Okay. That's what I thought, but I asked.
About the 590s BC. Okay. All right, so 605 BC, we have their first attack of Babylon. And here you have, for biblical purposes, you have Daniel and others, okay? All right, so the story of Daniel begins then, in the first siege. You have the second siege in 597. Okay, second siege in 597, and it is in this siege you have Ezekiel and many others. He takes thousands. What he leaves behind is the old and the infirmed. Okay, that's what he leaves behind. Okay, so you know he takes Ezekiel, and what he does is he moves them into an encampment, and the people, he moves them into an encampment outside of Babylon, along the shore of a river. The river's called Chebar. And that's where Ezekiel's visions, most of them, were actually given to him. And the first one, for sure. Alright, so he moves them to this place. Now again, he makes Ezekiel the prophet to the people who are in captivity. Ezekiel never returns home. Most of those people that Ezekiel spoke to never returned home. I mean, there may have been some infants that returned home out of that, but certainly no adults that heard Ezekiel begin his prophecy returned home. Which, again, I want to remind you, is contrary to what the false prophets were saying to them. In a couple of years, we'll be heading home. Okay. In the second siege, Nebuchadnezzar, again, did not destroy Jerusalem, nor did he destroy the temple. It was still, he went back and he got these captives. There were a lot of political things going on. All right, he was having some trouble with the loyalty of the king at that time. But remember, the king at that time was a king that he eventually changed his name to Zedekiah, and he was actually the puppet king. Okay. One was on was only there for a few months. He was displaced and taken in the first siege. Jehoiakim, who later name was changed, okay, he became king. He served for 11 years. But he was placed on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar as one who would give tribute to Nebuchadnezzar. He was still of the line of David. I would say to you, he's probably as far as I understand, he's the last king of the line of David. You come around to when Jesus is there. There's no king sitting on the throne of David that is of the line of David. Okay, the next one who sits on the throne of the line of David will be Messiah himself. Just jumped ahead a lot for you. Okay. There was this political problem, so Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes the second seat, and he pretty much, his first attempt to try to get Zedekiah or Jehoiakim back in line was to just remove, you know, all his military, all the people who were not just the old and the infirmed and stuff, but he didn't do it. Eventually, he comes back in on a third siege, and this king he takes with him. He takes his eyes out. He takes him back, and he dies in captivity. But that's the group that went in 597. They went to the river Chebar, and that's where they were at. And that's where Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, takes place at. Okay, now we have the third siege. Okay. The third siege of Nebuchadnezzar is in 586 B.C. Okay? And here is where you have the destruction of Jerusalem and temple. Okay? Now look at what I want you to see here is this is almost right in the middle, almost not quite in the middle of the time when Ezekiel was prophesying. So when he began prophesying, speaking the words of God, again I remind you that at the same time there were many false prophets because the city still stood, the temple still stood at this time, and at this time they still stood. There hadn't been a third siege. Okay, so these prophets were saying, we're going home soon. Now remember the prophet Jeremiah said, no, you will be in captivity for how many years? He told them, 70 years, okay. Of course, they didn't listen to Jeremiah no more than they listened to Ezekiel. They wanted the prophets that would make them feel good about what they were and what they did. And God says, no, you will. You have about here in 586, you have a wake-up call, if you will. You know, people don't want to deal with reality, and God brought reality home. They had listened to the false prophets. They had been rejecting what Ezekiel said. 586, Nebuchadnezzar goes back in. He takes the king into captivity, as I said, takes his eyes out. He destroys the wall. He destroys the Solomon's beautiful temple. He just lays waste to the whole thing. It become so burdensome to Nebuchadnezzar, it wasn't even worth just assimilating anymore. Just destroy it. Wipe it off the face of the earth. That was his view. Okay? And that happened in 586 B.C., you have the destruction of the first temple, you have the destruction of Jerusalem, and brings us in the midst of the prophecy of Ezekiel. Okay? So, if you think about it, his first six years, it was just this constant conflict between him and the false prophets. And nobody, of course, nobody believed him. So some people might ask, why does he spend, he spends the first chapter 4 through chapter 24 here in your outline that I've given you. He spends that many chapters trying to convince them of the reality of the judgment on Judah. Why? Well, he has 6 years in here that they're still being told by the false prophets that everything's going to be okay. We'll be heading home real soon. So you do have quite an extensive length of time that he deals with that judgment against Judah, God's ultimate and complete judgment against Judah. And then chapter 25 through 29, you have four or five chapters there that he actually deals with the judgments of the other nations. Okay, and again, you're probably reminded that almost every one of the prophets not only dealt with the judgment against God's people, but the judgment against the other nations that were surrounding them too.
Wasn't there a prophecy before? In other words, it was prophesied that the temple would be torn down and stuff even before Ezekiel's time.
Yeah, I am sure that both Jeremiah and Isaiah spoke of that, but I can't give you the exact thing about it. Yeah.
So, I mean,
I think when the group is going through Jeremiah, I think Jeremiah deals with that the destruction of the temple.
If they prophesied that, why in the world would the people listen to them?
Because they didn't believe the prophets. It's just like today. A majority of people don't want to hear the things of God. God always has a remnant. There were some that were listening to Ezekiel. There were some that were listening to Jeremiah. But as a nation, they had rejected God. And so they don't want to hear what God has to say. Just like today, the majority does not want to hear what God has to say to his people. And the church has followed the same steps as Old Testament Israel has done. We've become very callous to the voice of God. And we have replaced the living God in our minds with our own programs, our own agendas, and all these kind of things, our own talents, our own giftedness. We replace God, and we think that somehow it's impressive to God and proves who we are, but all it really does is it is put forth to the world and to God. We say, God, we don't need you. It's a sad thing. It's exactly where they were. Exactly where they were. They had said to God, we don't need you. They didn't want to hear from God anymore. Okay? Any other question?
The Chebar River must have been awfully small. It's not on any of my...
It should be just south of Babylon on your if you have it on your maps. And it runs for quite a few miles. I think it's a branch off the I want to say off the Euphrates. It's a lower branch off the Euphrates River. Okay? It makes sense that they would put people on a river. You know, to supply their you know what their needs and stuff like that, and we learned this when we went to Israel last time. Every time we go to Israel, they make two points where they build cities. They build cities on hills. Why? For protection, and they always build cities at a source of water. So almost anywhere in the Middle East you find a city, you will also find a well. Makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, they didn't have irrigation system in the sense that you can pump water in and stuff like that. All right. Any question? Yes, Sandy.
In answer to your question, in Jeremiah 5, it says, roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem and look now and take note and seek in her open squares if you can find a man. If there is one who does justice, who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. But... They don't listen.
Yeah.
Okay. Jeremiah 5, chapter 5.
You okay with the little bit of historical background? You got that? The timing, who his contemporaries are and stuff like that. His message. You ready to go into the book itself? All right, let's read chapter 1 together. says, now it came to pass in the 13th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, that I was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. Okay? So, here we go again. Where's he at? In Babylon, by the river Chebar. Who is he with? He's with the other captives that came out of the second siege of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. That's where he is. What is he receiving? He's receiving, it says, I saw visions of God. That word of there, again, could be of or from. Okay? Again, I want to remind you that the Hebrew is not quite as exact as the Greek is. The articles in the Greek are very exact, where you're saying of or from or through or whatever. Hebrew is not quite like that. The point is that what he's receiving now is he's receiving these visions that God has given him. And he begins in this first chapter with an incredible vision. And we'll talk, by the way, we won't have time to read ahead, but the 10th chapter of this book, if you want to read ahead, will tell you what the vision is. I'll tell you what it is in a minute because the 10th chapter tells us. But okay, so it says, on the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim captivity. So where's this is Jehoiakim. This is Jehoiachin. It's not Jehoiakim. Oh boy, why didn't they just name them? You know, Ralph and Joe. I don't know. This is the one that Nebuchadnezzar, remember, in the first siege, he took him into captivity. By the way, Jeremiah prophesied this. You will be taken into captivity, okay? And you will die in a foreign land. He is taken into captivity. Then Jehoiakim is placed upon the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. Jehoiakim's name is later changed, he's also called Zedekiah. Okay? Same guy. That is the same guy. Okay, Jehoiachin and Jehoiakim are not the same guy, but they're both descendants of David. And so, what he tells us here is that Jehoiachin has been in captivity for 5 years now in Babylon. So that would tell you that what he this vision's coming around 600 A.D.
B.C.,
excuse me. Whoa. Yes, thank you. B.C. Okay. Everybody got that? So, all right. So, verse 3, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest. So we know he's a priest. Not only is he a priest, but he is a prophet. Now, I told you I was going to do this where we did the whole vision, but it's not going to happen. You know that. Okay. So, the priest, because there's so much background we have to deal with. There are three offices in the Old Testament system that God gave to Israel. There is the prophet, there is a priest, and there is the king. All of them called and anointed of God. Okay? Now, of course, we understand, hopefully we understand, that in one man we have all these things to be true. That's Christ, right? He is our prophet, he is our priest, and he is our king. Amen? Okay. So, the priest was the one who was to go to God on behalf of the people. In the Roman Catholic system, they continue that thought. They're priests. You know, you go to the priest, you give confession to the priest receives the confession, and they take your confession to God. In the Old Testament, remember, they would bring their sacrifices to the priest, and the priest would take their sacrifices and offer the sacrifices to God, right? So they would go to the priest. Do we still go to the priest? Yes, we do. The great high priest, Jesus Christ. Not through a man. Okay? So in our churches, in what we consider to be evangelical or biblical churches, we have no such office as exclusionary priest office. We say this. You are all priests before God. We believe in the priesthood of the believer. Which means you all of us as believers have been given the privilege to go directly into the presence of God. But in the Old Testament time, only the priest could do that. So the priest would take things to God. So Ezekiel was a priest. But not only was he a priest, he was a prophet. Because a prophet, was, the difference here in this office is that the prophet would actually hear things from God and share them with the people. So the priest took things to God on behalf of the people. The prophet heard from God and shared those things with the people. Okay? And then, of course, the king. Now, I would say to you, Hebrews chapter 1 makes it very clear to me. God, who spoke in various times and in various ways to our fathers through the prophets, has now spoken to us in these last days through His Son, Christ Jesus. I'm not looking for a priest. I'm not looking for a prophet. I'm not looking for a king. I already got one. Okay? I really believe this. I believe He fulfills all His offices for the church today. So those are not offices that have to be fulfilled anymore. Okay, He does that. So, the word of the Lord came expressly, exclusively to Ezekiel. Ezekiel is God's prophet for His people at the river Chebar. And that's what He's trying to say here. No, there's a lot of guys speaking, understand that. But Ezekiel is God's man for His people. The son of Buzai in the land of the Chaldeans. Another word for Chaldeans would be the Babylonians. Okay, so when you see that word, Chaldeans or Babylonians, it's the same people by the river Chebar. And the hand of the Lord was upon him there. So now we're going to see this incredible vision that God gives him. Verse 4. Then I looked, and I'm going to go ahead and read through verse 14. So just follow along. It said, then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing it, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of fire. Also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces. Each one had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calf's feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. They had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. Each had four faces and wings. Their wings touched one another, and the creature did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. Their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of each one touched the other, and two covered their bodies. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire and like the appearance of torches. Fire was going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightnings, and the living creatures ran back and forth in the appearance like a flash of lightning. That'll wake you up in the morning. Okay? Nowhere else do we have such a description. Okay? Ezekiel chapter 10 tells you who these four living creatures are. Now, when you... Isaiah speaks of living creatures. Okay? But he doesn't describe them this way. These four living creatures... Ezekiel chapter 10 tells you that these are a class of angels. And they are cherub. These are cherubim. Okay? These are cherubim. Different from what Isaiah saw when he went into the throne room of God, and he actually says that the seraphim took the coals off of the altar and touched his lips with it. Okay, these are called cherubim. Again, singular would be cherub. You put the im on the end, you have the plural. Okay, interesting. How did he describe them? He describes them as a likeness unto man. In other words, the appearance, if you could see them standing there, you would see a human form. Yet, that's not all that he talks about there. But he says when their appearance was that as a man. So in their body form, what we get a picture is would be the body of a man. But there's other things going on here. He said this. He said they did not turn, which means they weren't doing this. What's he mean? He said when they went straight forward. Now, you're going to find out they can go in all directions here in a minute. But the point is, when they go in whatever direction they go, that's where they go. You know, they're not turning looking to the left. They're not turning looking to the right. They are focused. They are heading in the path that the one we'll see in just a moment who is behind them is directing them. Okay? These are angels of God, and they are frightful things. It's no wonder when the angels appear to men in the Scripture, you have men that would fall down and some of them begin in acts of worship. And remember, the true angel would say, don't do that. I'm a servant just like you are. But they were so incredibly powerful looking in the essence of who they were, they would take a man's breath away. Okay? Now, again, what I would think maybe you'd find interesting is there were times when angels appeared completely in the likeness of men. In other words, their glory from what they actually look like was covered. One occurrence of this, it's the same way when we talk about, can you imagine what Christ looks like? Okay, we get the two clearest pictures we get is in Daniel in Revelation. And remember when John saw Christ in Revelation, he didn't look anything like what John saw Jesus looking like for the 3 years. Okay? And he was overwhelmed in his presence. And his description was quite an incredible description. But you remember that it was a pre-incarnate Christ who appeared to Abraham as a man. But he wasn't alone. He had two angels with him. Okay? These were the angels that went into Sodom and Gomorrah. And when they went into Sodom and Gomorrah, they were so much in the likeness of men. Remember what the men of Sodom and Gomorrah wanted. They wanted these men to come out because they wanted to have their way with them. And they were blinded. I get this vision. And again, of course, it's my own vision. It doesn't say... I can only imagine that in that instant when he blinded them, what they did was they just pretty much just peeled back the veneer of flesh and just boom, you know, instantaneously blinded the whole crowd so that Lot and his family could get out of that place. This is quite a picture. He talks about these cherubim as each four of them, and each four of them had interesting, they had like four heads on them. One was the head of a man. One was the head of an ox or cow. One was the head of a lion, and one was the head of an eagle. This has always been a mystery to me. Maybe you've clarified it in your mind and stuff like that. I've had commentators say everything from each one represents one of the four gospels. You know, that, you know, each one of the heads speak of the different, even the different groups and different approach of the four gospels. I don't know anybody who can tell you what it means. I don't. I think some of these things are mysteries to us that we can have conjectures like anything else. We can say, well, you know, this could mean that. But we also have to be very careful to say, unless the Bible says this is what it is, we can't speak further than the Bible speaks. We can't speak. Yes, Ms. Smith.
When we go to heaven,
yes,
will we see these creatures?
Yes, we will. We will see these creatures.
But it'll be okay.
It'll be okay.
They won't hurt you.
Here's what's on. We say, wow, how glorious are these creatures. But here's the point. They pale in comparison to the glory of God. That ought to stagger us a little bit. Because, you know, no one has seen, you know, when the Bible says no one has seen the face of God and live, what that word there in the Hebrew is panim. It does not literally mean the facial features of God. The word means presence. And the term simply means this: no one can stand in the full presence of God and live. Remember what God actually did? You know, he did, when it talks about that he let Moses see his backside. Again, it's human terminology that we use to basically say that God allowed him to see a portion of his glory, but he did not allow him to see the fullness of his glory because he couldn't live. Yet look at what it did to Moses just to see a portion of his glory. He had to wear a veil over his head, you know, because he glowed, you know. You know, I guess. Even him spending that time in the presence of God made him into a fearsome man, that his face had to be veiled before the people. It's just, you know, and remember what these descriptive terms are human words to describe something that is beyond our full comprehension. So he uses these word pictures to help us understand.
My little footnote for that says four, which stands for completeness. The four directions, the quarters of the earth, which is in Isaiah. So, but it does go down further to say it represents the four gospels, as in Revelation. So, that's my footnote.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
So
yes. Yeah, Sandy, I'm sorry.
These are the same cherubim that guarded the tree of life. And they're the same ones that were by the mercy seat?
I don't know if they're the exact same ones. They are cherubim.
Yeah. But in the singular, Satan's also called a cherub.
He's the anointed cherub.
Right.
So it tells you what class of angel he was.
Mm-hmm.
I say class. I'm just saying the Bible describes them differently,
yeah,
and being different. But clearly, most would put Michael, the archangel, as a cherub. Would put Lucifer, who we know as Satan, and the Bible calls him the anointed cherub. It speaks of, he had an exalted position in heaven. Okay? He convinced one third of the angels to go with him. He had some whatever. Okay? But these are the cherubs. These are the cherubs. These are the cherubs that were, remember when God gave instructions to Moses to place the cover upon the Ark of the Covenant. He said that you will place these cherubs on top with the wings. They're described elsewhere as, and I think it may be the 10th chapter where it talks about that they had eyes covering everything.
Yeah.
Okay? And the point of that is not so much that they look like, see, when we use the description, they almost look like monsters to us. Okay? He's using descriptive words to try to speak of the fullness of what they could do. To say that they had eyes everywhere meant that there was nothing that they didn't see. Okay? When it talks about their wings, it talks about their wings, you know, two to fly and two to cover their own body and stuff, you know, and the word picture there is to try to speak of in human words how magnificent these angelic beings are and the fullness of what they could do. All right? So, any other question? Yes?
I'd like to have one of those personally around my house.
You probably do. You know what? I always say, well, are these the guardian angels? And, you know, again, let me just throw this out. I don't worry so much about guardian angels. See, what I believe is we as a church, we have the Holy Spirit who indwells us. He's our protector. Okay? That I would deny that the angels still minister, because even the New Testament talks about there are ministering angels. Okay? He also warns us to be careful that you may entertain an angel unaware. Okay? It is in the New Testament that he gives warning. He said, don't you harm one of these little ones. Because even their angel in heaven, you know, these people who harm these children, they have no concept of what awaits them. And Jesus warned him, said, it'd be better for you to have a millstone thrown around your neck and you'd be thrown in the depths of the sea than you to harm one of these little ones.
Well, What's the difference between a cherubim and a seraphim then? Seraphims were the ones that guarded the ark, right?
No, cherubim. We have the seraphim. We have the seraphs or the seraphim in the throne room of God. Okay, that's how they're described for us. They are in the throne room of God, the seraph. It is believed that the cherubim would be, if I can put it this way, would be almost like the warring angels. The ones that go forth. It's what he says here. These are the ones that go forth to and all over the earth. Okay? It doesn't tell us what kind of angels came and ministered to the Lord. Doesn't tell us. Cherubim or seraphim. You have a big debate over that. Some people say it was a seraphim that came because they're the ones that sat over the throne of God or by the throne of God. You know, I don't know. It doesn't say, so I'm not going to say. Okay? Any other question? You want to talk about a well-oiled machine, if I can put it that way. When these four cherubs went together, they were together. That's what he describes here. The picture here, a singular purpose, a singular unit that God has sent to Ezekiel. But he doesn't send them alone. But before we get there, let's read a little bit further. Yes, Sue.
They can't be omnipresent, though.
No, they can't. No.
Yeah.
But their abilities, it's much like the ability of our enemy, the devil. Their abilities are incredible. They would certainly seem superhuman to us. Okay? Satan is not omnipresent, nor does he omniscient. Does he know everything? But he has certainly been studying human history and human psychology for thousands of years, and he knows us. You know, and we're so predictable. I mean, after we've been married for a few years, we can predict what our spouse is going to do. So he shouldn't have any problem with us. You know, who in here knows how to push the button on their spouse? Okay, so here we go.
Who here knows not to do it?
Oh yeah, well that's another thing. I wish they hadn't. Okay, verse 15 says, "Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each of the creature with its four faces." So you have four creatures with four faces, and now you have four wheels, one by each of the creature. And this is, he's going to describe it this way, as a wheel within a wheel. That remind you of anything that we know about?
What's the song?
Huh?
Wheels, then wheels.
Ezekiel saw the wheel.
Big wheel by faith.
Oh. Anybody, never mind what she's saying. Let's go on. Okay. That just water in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
We sang that in Sunday school.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It is a real song.
Okay.
You're too young.
I'm too young. What's that? There's a term that we use that is very, I don't believe this is what it is, but it's so close to what this, how do you describe? You've ever heard of a gyroscope? Okay. As far as I know, there's never been a clear, from our limited experience as human beings, there has never been a clear picture of what this these wheels possibly could have been other than a gyroscope. Okay? And what does a gyroscope do? Basically, you put it in a plane, it keeps it level, and some of the thoughts of some of the things that some of the flying machines can do now is not only, you know, I've seen jets go straight up, and you begin to see them going sideways and stuff. Well, what allows them to do stuff like that? Same type of thing we're talking about right here.
To give a stable.
Yes. Form. Yeah. Exactly right.
So it would stay.
It levels everything out and allows it to go, particularly in full function, in any direction it wants to.
Right.
Without it changes direction without. Remember what he said. They don't turn.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm not a gyroscope, so if I want to go this way without bumping into something, I've got to fully turn. Not so here. Okay? So let's read on. The appearance of the wheel and the worst was like the color of beryl. What color is beryl?
Red.
It's a red color. Remember, he's already talked about the lightnings and the fire and all that stuff that we've seen here. And all four had the same likeness. So all four of these wheels look exactly alike. The appearance of their works was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Okay? A gyroscope. Again, that's what we call it. But I'm sure that these are much better than anything man can make. You always have to wonder if sort of, you know, when God, when the person invented the gyroscope, you know, if they went back and saw this and thought about, you know, it's already been, you know, thousands of years ago, it's already been described before it was ever really created by man or invented by man. Okay? Verse 17, when they went toward any of the one of four directions. So what could they do? It's almost like he sees them heading right for them. That's what he says, first part. And if they wanted to go to the left, what did they do? They went to the left. How did they do it? They went together. They were so locked in. Okay? And remember he said they didn't turn. They didn't have to turn to go. They just went. And they could go in any direction. Instantaneously. Now, I don't know if we have any flying machines today that can do that. At full speed, change direction. Okay? So that's why some people say they've seen UFOs, because they've seen UFOs do stuff that airplane, we don't think airplanes we have yet can do. That is, they can go in one direction, all of a sudden change direction. You understand what I'm saying? Without a gradual turning or something like that, that they can change direction. That's what he's saying that these four cherubim can do. When they went toward one of four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. You understand the terminology? They didn't have to. If I want to go right, I've got to turn right and head right. Or I'm going to, you know. They don't have to do that. Okay? They don't have to turn like we do. They can go in any direction, anytime they want, at any speed that they want, instantaneously. Now, we can get a concept of that because we live in more modern times. But can you imagine the mind of Ezekiel seeing this kind of thing when they've never seen anything like this in the sky that could do something like this? By the way, stay away from the history channels when it comes to this garbage. Because what they want to do, they're going to take you in Ezekiel and say, Ezekiel saw UFOs. See? You know I couldn't believe it. The other day I was watching something. They were advertising another one of their little history thing. They were saying, and Jonah, who was taken in a well-shaped UFO. So he wasn't swallowed by a great fish. There was a well-shaped UFO. That's what Jonah was in for 3 days and three nights. Okay. All right. Verse 18. As for their rims, they were so high, they were awesome. And their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. So again, full of eyes. They could see anywhere, any direction, any time. Didn't matter where they were going, what direction they were going in, they could see in front of them, they could see back of them, they could see left of them, they could see right of them. They were fully aware of what was going on. That's what that term, all eyes, are there. Okay. Verse 19, when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Okay. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went, because there the spirit went, and the wheels were lifted together with them. Now the spirit here, again, speaks of the angel, not so much the spirit of God, if you think it's the angel. Wherever the angel or the spirit, the spiritual creature wanted to go, the wheels went with him. That's what he's saying. Right? For the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So, the wheels were so connected to the angel that wherever the angel, the wheels were not the angel. Okay? The wheels were not the angel. But, again, my generation, I can't help but go, you know, I think about Star Trek, I think about Star Wars, I think about all these things where, you know, you have these pictures of where just simply, you know, the mind of the, I don't know if you remember Star Wars, where Luke was coming in and finally the Yoda guy says, Luke, you have to let go. He was basically saying, don't trust the machine. Now, this can go into Eastern mysticism mind control. I understand that. But here's a picture he was trying to tell him. Don't trust the machine. Trust your own spirit. And here's a picture here from a good sense, in the sense that what he's saying here, they weren't driving these machines. The very essence of who these angelic beings were was what was make the machine do what it did. The wheels going where they needed to go. Okay?
Okay, we all understand, don't we?
Okay. You know, and here's the point. I don't know that we're expected to understand the magnitude here. I think we're to... Can you imagine, you know, the first time that the Lord reveals himself fully to you, he does it in this way. Amen. By the way, these four living creatures are not alone, but we won't have time to find out who's with them this morning. Okay? So, we will finish chapter 1 and go into chapter 2 next week. We did spend quite a little bit of time on the historical background, but we needed to do that. You need to know when this took place and why God had put Ezekiel in this place.
It's 11 o'clock.
Yes, it is.
My word.
I think.